You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Last week when we had Neil Puckett on, I asked him if he knew who the artist was. It was Santana. I mean, it was period appropriate for my guest. And he tanked it, so I'm not even going to ask him this time. Although those are the Beach Boys, again, period appropriate music. But rejoining me now, a week later, is Neil Puckett, retired Marine, intelligence officer, and staff judge advocate. And currently an attorney that does has done a lot of pretty famous court-martial cases that we've seen, Abu Ghraib and Haditha. So, Neil, first of all, thanks for coming back on. Thanks for doing this.
Great to be with you, man. Happy to help.
Just as a kind of a refresher, give everybody a couple of minute thumbnail bio of Neil Puckett.
Sure. So I served in the Marine Corps from 1977 to 1997. I went in as an unrestricted officer, got an MOS at the basic school, was an intelligence officer, was recruited into counterintelligence. That occupied the first 4 years of my career. Those two fields. I served with an infantry battalion, 1-8, 1st Battalion, 8th Marines.
Cool.
And then went off to law school for 3 years, came back to the Marine Corps, went to Camp Pendleton, and was there for 4 years, serving 1 year as a defense counsel, 1 year as a deputy staff judge advocate to 1st Marine Division, and then 2 years as a prosecutor. And then I went back to law school for a postgraduate law degree in criminal law. Then I spent 3 years as a military judge in Okinawa. Went back to school after that to the Naval War College, to the College of Naval Command and Staff for 1 year. Went back to being a military judge for 2 years at 29 Palms. And finally was transferred back to Okinawa as the officer in charge of the Legal Service Support Section, or the legal office, the Marine Corps Legal Office on Okinawa. Retired in 1997. took a job in Pensacola as an assistant federal public defender for about a year and a half, and then moved to Northern Virginia, opened a law practice in military criminal defense, which means I represented service members from all branches against criminal charges in courts-martial or administrative allegations in administrative separation processes and boards of inquiry for officers. Was recruited into the Navy to be to train defense counsel, to train Navy defense counsel worldwide in complex litigation and sexual assault cases, how best to defend those. So I developed and delivered cutting-edge trial advocacy training to those folks, including Marines and Coast Guards judge advocates. And after that, I was soft recruited over into the Naval Inspector General's office where I now serve.
You left out. You worked at Starbucks. I can't believe that was the one thing.
I did. I did 8 months. When I first moved to North Virginia, I did leave that out. I worked for eight months at local Starbucks. I was a shift supervisor and loved it. Got lots of good training. Got lots of good experience and drank lots of coffee.
I know that's pathetic of me. Of all the things in your bio, like that's what you remember. Like here, I've done all this great stuff in my life, and you know, now I'm a barista for the rest of my life. And all right, we're going to talk about Haditha today, and talk to us how Haditha darkens your doorstep.
Well, so for your listeners who don't know, it was a pretty significant event back in November of 2005, 19 November 2005. The event happened. I was unaware of it, but I got a phone call from Staff Sergeant Woodrich's wife. Staff Sergeant Woodrich, who was a sergeant at the time, was the squad leader at Haditha, and I was. Basically hired by him to represent him in early 2006 when NCIS first started getting involved. brief facts about Haditha. There was a squad that was kind of on a milk run. They were replacing some six Iraqi guards at a checkpoint, picking out some chow and some water and some Swiftover gear. They were on their way back to their firm base, and an IED exploded underneath the third Humvee and a four Humvee convoy. And it's the traditional all hell broke loose. You know, the thing was blasted sky high. A Marine was cut in half. Two other Marines were fairly grievously wounded. And young Sergeant Wittrich, this was his first day in combat, his first day to hear a shot fired in anger, was on the spot to figure out what to do.
Okay.
So they radioed for the quick reaction force, and things kind of unraveled from there.
All right, and we'll get into that more detail here in a little bit.
Sure.
His wife contacts you in, did you say April of 2006?
Springtime of 2006.
Okay. All right. And so you're involved in defending Sergeant Woodridge from 2006 to when the case finally goes to trial in January of 2012. And so for six years, you represent him.
Exactly right.
So, you know, Neil, I've broken down this thing into about our interview into about six phases. If you don't mind, I'm going to go through the phases real quick so everybody will understand the way we're going to look at it, and then we'll get after it. The first phase is there's some events in the pre-deployment training that I think are important that people understand as you try to get your hands around Haditha. And then there's the actual events of that day, November of 2005. And then there's a period, and this is what I'll call phase two. So pre-deployment's phase is phase one. Phase two that we'll look at is the events that day, and then there's a period of time where this is an internal event to 3-1 Second Marine Division and 2MEP. So we'll talk about that. Phase three is starts when the Time magazine article is published, and that really sets DOD on fire, sets the American media on fire. And then that's to me an external period. The NCIS investigation gets going, and then charges are levied. So that'll be phase three that we'll talk about. Phase four in fact, the charges, and then immunity that's granted by the convening authority, and the initial convening authority is General Mattis in his capacity as the commander of Marsh Cent, and also as 1MEP. So that's phase four. Phase five is the court-martial of Cecil and Woodrich. And then phase six that we'll do is lessons learned. And one of the cool parts about having you on today, Neil, is that you are a Marine officer. And so I would imagine that the lessons learned piece of this is the most significant relative to your experience as a Marine officer, and hoping that maybe one day this would be presented at the basic school, so that a couple things could be put in the heads of young officers, also staff, NCO Academy, squad leaders course, all those kinds of things. One, this can happen to you, and you have to be mentally prepared for the ball to be hit in that direction. And if the ball is hit in that direction, what do you do? What is your responsibility to yourself? What is your responsibility to the institution? And what is your responsibility to your Marines? So we'll get to all that today. So that's how we'll do it. First of all, let's talk pre-deployment training. 3-1 participates in Mojave Viper, as everybody did. Mojave Viper, pretty robust training with actors and a lot of different things at that point. As the Marine Corps refined its pre-deployment training to make it more realistic, in the hopes that that would help more Marines to survive. B, by being better prepared for the complex situations they would go into, that they would be able to handle them better. during Mojave Viper, they clear, obviously clearing buildings is a piece of that. Talk about that. What does the term clear mean in the context of 3-1?
In the context of 3-1, it's the notion of clearing a building or clearing a room has to do with, and Marines who are listening will understand this, has to do with eliminating any threats that are in there. But it's important to understand that depending on what combat action or enemy TTPs displayed preceded that determines the rules of engagement that will apply to that clearing. Now, in Haditha, what they learned in their training was the training they did not get was close quarters combat, close quarter battle type of hostage rescue, for instance. So, hostage rescue specially trained folks are told, for instance, to look at hands, watch hands, go into a room and watch people's hands. Do they have weapons? Do they not have weapons? What are they doing with their weapons? So that's one type of mission that you would have for clearing. That was not the training that these Marines received. What these Marines received was training that was applied that day was assume that the building you're entering has been declared hostile. And what that means is that the building is being used by hostile forces. You've verified this. You've been just told this. You've identified positive intent
positive identification.
PID? Positive identification, hostile act or hostile intent, right, is what I was looking for. And if that's the case, then even if the reality is that non-combatants are in the building or being used by insurgents or whatever, if the analogy is if the building's been declared hostile, then you can call in air and you can drop a bomb on it and you can level the building. More care is required when human beings are clearing it, when Marines are clearing it, when grunts are clearing it. So there's a fine line, I hate to give a lawyer answer, but it depends on how they do it. Depends on what their understanding of the combat situation is for that building.
Okay.
So that training was given to them, and I want to say one more thing about their training that I recall from the case, and that is the Marines of 3-1 did very, very well at Mojave Viper, and they were told, I mean, they scored really well, and they were given lots of kudos. We had evidence from Marines in 3-1 that their battalion commander told them, understand you did great, really appreciate you guys doing well in the training, but when we get to Haditha Dam, I want you to do it harder. I want you to go in harder. So think in terms of this was not hard enough. I want you to go against the enemy harder than the training at Mojave Viper taught you.
Okay. All right. So clear is not really, you kind of contrasted what they were taught to a hostage rescue thing where you're going in the room and identifying friend or foe in this connotation. Right. And the Fluge example is kind of, in my opinion, is kind of a bad one, but you hear people use it all the time because we had sat on Fallujah for, 8 months? And before we went in there, so, you know, we had dropped leaflets on it. Pretty much everybody that was there to fight. And so, and there weren't too many people there. And so to me, in retrospect, and you know, the teaching that is, you can see in an insurgency where it can become problematic. I want to talk about one other part about their mindset going over there. They were replacing 3rd Battalion, 24th Marines. Right. My recollection is they were the most bloodied battalion during the Marine participation in the Iraq War.
They suffered the most one-day casualties of any unit in Iraq.
Talk to me about so in terms of when they so 3-1 is watching this, you know, in their mind, what are they going into? What are they mentally prepared for after you know becoming familiar with 324?
Well, they believe that they're going into the most contested area of Iraq and the area with the greatest degree of insurgent activity, and I wouldn't say they're scared, but they're prepared to do battle and do a lot of it and do it every day. I mean that's the mindset, and it's not just coming from the training; it's also coming from intel briefings that they're getting from the S2, the G2, and S2 guys. It's hard to overemphasize the dangerous environment that all the Marines in 3-1 had in their heads. So they expected from initial arrival that their presence was going to be contested on a daily basis, and they were going to have to be on the lookout for attacks all the time.
Okay. So that's their mindset going in. Anything else about anything that happened in pre-deployment phase that I have not? This is the general question. It's very akin to the general article. Is there anything else about their pre-deployment thing that sticks out that you think people ought to know?
Nothing that I recall. The Marines that we talked to who were in the unit told us about the numerous ROE briefings and numerous intel briefings, and I can't remember whether any of them actually got to talk to the 324 guys, but they were well aware of that story and they talked about it all the time. They didn't actually initially get the kind of frequent contact that they thought they were going to get, so that made them even more nervous about, you know, when's it coming.
Got it. Let's talk about, just so I correct myself, it's 3rd Battalion, 25th Marines, not 24th Marines.
Oh, 25th Marines, okay.
All right, so lest anybody be offended, please don't. The events of that day. Can you walk us through in kind of I have a schematic up, and you'll find it in the on the read board. If you just do a search, if you just actually type in Haditha, you'll see something on the read board, and it's a graphic I got. But can you just walk us through the wave top events of that day, Neil?
Yes, I can. So we already talked about what the situation was with the morning resupply run and the IED going off. So I'm just gonna hit the wave tops, and then if you want to talk in more detail, we can do that.
Okay.
So as soon as the IED goes off, the Humvees herringbone they move out and kind of. Assume immediately defensive positions and prepare to prepare for an additional attack. They begin to dismount. Attention is focused by Sessor and Woodridge and some others on the IED site itself. Looking for survivors, radioing back for the quick reaction force. And a lot of confusion, a lot of kind of horror about what has gone on. I guess it was a huge fireball, and parts of the Humvee were raining down on everybody, and it was a bad situation. Within just a few seconds, a white car with five military-age males, pulls up towards the front of the, kind of pulls over to the side towards the front of the, alongside one of the, either the first or the second Humvee, actually the first Humvee, and five guys get out. And we're talking within the first 60 seconds after the thing goes off. They are immediately told to stop and get down by one of the Marines up front, and they begin to flee. And under the rules of engagement at the time, military-aged males immediately fleeing from within some degree of proximity to an IED exploding, fleeing or failing to obey commands. And the commands, by the way, were given in Arabic. So the guys were trained to, basic Arabic commands about stop, put your weapon down or whatever the basic commands were. They were given those, and they were ignoring them and dispersing. So the Marine in the front of the convoy opened fire on those five males. There was some supporting fire from Staff Sergeant Woodard from about 75 to 100 meters away. Those five guys are now down. So the quick reaction force arrives under the command of a lieutenant, and the Marines who are there start taking fire from a particular direction. There are rounds impacting the ground. Several Marines reported seeing rounds impacting the ground. That's reported to the lieutenant. The lieutenant tells Staff Sergeant Woodrich to grab some Marines and clear south. He points in the southerly direction and because there's one house that had been identified by one of the Marines where he believed the firing was coming from. Whether he's right or not, who knows, but that was the report. Right. So Staff Sergeant Woodrich and three other Marines grab their weapons, run down a wadi, run back up the other side to the first house. And again, we're just going to do wave tops here. They enter the house. They immediately kill someone on entry. They go through the rooms. Some shots are fired, and one of the Marines, says runner, shouts runner, meaning he sees someone running from the house or running outside. So they exit out the back of the house in a general direction where they thought the runner was going, and that led to the next house. And that house is referred to in the investigation as House 2. And in House 2, they sort of assume a tactical posture alongside the house. One of the Marines sees a man dressed in black come to a window, a door with a window in it, opens fire on him. The Marines immediately flow inside the house. It turns out there's a kitchen right there, a kitchen area. There's a hallway. They see another room. They frag the room. The frag grenade doesn't go off. They had run back outside. They come back in, they refrag it, and then they begin, there was no one in that room, and they begin clearing rooms individually. There's a back bedroom, and in the back bedroom, there are women and children, and the mother of the household was killed through the open door. A grenade was thrown in the room, which did not go off. Marines went in the room and killed everyone in the room, including children dressed colorfully in colorful pajamas while lying on a bed, women and children only in the room. And the time sequencing here, I'm not being very specific about that because that becomes more important later. And then the Marines are outside. They end up going back to the main sort of collection point or rally point there where the IED went off. And later, they've got some Marines in an overwatch position. They see a guy running between the houses, and he's shot and killed because he looks suspicious. And they're still in kind of a very tactical situation. Right. And then someone notices some suspicious activity. Near two houses that are on the other side of a main road from where this house one and house two are, and those houses are referred to as houses three and four, house three and house four.
Okay.
And as a result of further inquiry at that house and clearing one of those houses, four military-age males with AK-47s in the same room with them were killed. And at the end of the day, 24 Iraqis are dead. Varying ages and genders, but mostly the center of gravity of the number are women and children.
Okay. Could you?
So that's what happened.
Okay. Could you kind of walk me through? So the IED goes off. The white vehicle. We have five at the white vehicle. If you wouldn't mind doing the math with me. House one. How many people are killed in house one?
I don't have that number firmly in my head, but I want to say. Let me just count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think 5.
Okay. House 2?
8.
Okay. Are house 3 and 4 kind of rolled together in terms of time?
No killings in house 3, but house 4, 4.
Okay, so that's what, 5, 10, 18, 22. And you said there was one more killed running? Is he counted in this number?
Yes, he has counted that number. Does that come to 23?
That comes to 23.
Okay, so then there may have been, I think, did I say 5 in house 1? There may have been 6 in house 1.
Okay, all right. I just want people to get a general sense of how many people we're talking about. All right, so is there anything else? We'll come back to some of the events, specifics of the events later. Anything else about the day that people need to be familiar with? This is as it turns out,
yes.
There's a series of attacks. There's drone footage and some other stuff. And so this is not looked at as by, this doesn't develop as just a single IED incident. This kind of develops, at least for the company, as a day-long fight in and around Haditha. Is that fair?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's not only fair, it's been proven by intelligence.
Okay. Okay. Anything else? Any other footnotes that you would provide? I thought your general description was good.
Yeah. No, all I would say was that the Marines throughout the rest of the day and into the early evening participated in assisting with moving the bodies to a downtown medical facility and generally kind of, I don't want to say cleaning up after themselves, but assisting in any way they could. I guess a salient point is one of the HET team members human exploitation team members was asked to grab his camera and take photographs and document the casualties, the KIAs there.
Okay.
So he very carefully numbered and photographed the rooms sort of at a distance and also each individual body and he and one other person, I think there were two people all together who were asked to take photographs. So there was photographic documentation of how the rooms looked and how the victims looked.
But not
taken by who ordered it?
Yeah, who orders it? Do you know?
I don't know. It may have been the company commander.
Okay.
But I'm sure it was an officer.
Right.
But yeah, so that was just I think there was a requirement that they, you know, run identities through a identity checking system just to see if they could figure out, you know, afterwards who was who.
Okay. All right. So that takes us through the day. Now, the next phase is what I've, you know, ineptly named the internal phase. This is now a 3-1 incident, 2nd Marine Division incident, 2 meth incident. I guess the question that most people ask during this phase is no investigation. How does it happen that there is no investigation? Because I said last week, there's never been a time that I've taken a breath in either Iraq or Afghanistan that that I'll just use the two houses. 13 civilians killed wasn't a big number. And that's subtracting the military age males at the initial vehicle and the four in-house four. That's still a big number. How does this, in terms of your observation, how does this not get investigated by the battalion, the regiment, the division, the MEF?
Well, and that's something that really really casts the entire situation in sort of a bad light, because the commanding officer is responsible for, you know, everything the unit does or fails to do, and all of us involved in the case were scratching our heads about how is there not a JAG manual investigation? How is there not a look into what happened that day? Debriefing the Marines. You know, everybody sits down and you know, everybody writes a statement, writes your story. You don't have to suspect anybody and read them their rights and make it a criminal thing. You just want to say, okay, Marines, for training purposes, what happened that day? What do we do wrong? What do we do right? Lessons learned. And let's piece this together, and then if it turns out that things weren't done properly, and maybe people were even a little bit reckless, you know, you show up to training, and worst case scenario is you say, hey, something went wrong here, or you determine that somebody did something maybe intentionally wrong, and the process is you call an NCIS and say, well, you know, I think we need to make a full criminal investigation of this. But backing up a little bit, as a commanding officer, I would have wanted to know what happened, and I would have wanted. So killing civilians is a bad thing. It's a bad thing in anybody's rule book. So I would want an investigation to either clear my Marines of any wrongdoing. You know, it's collateral damage. It couldn't be helped. We followed the rules of engagement. Civilians got in the way of our rounds. So those things happen.
Right.
Or in the alternative, if it turns out that something had gone terribly, terribly wrong and guys had done things they know violate the law of land warfare, then as a leader and as a Marine officer, I would want those individuals held accountable. I mean, I owe that to the Marine Corps. I owe that to the American public, the Iraqi public. I owe it to myself professionally as a leader to hold people accountable for bad behavior.
Okay, so why doesn't the battalion investigate? Why doesn't the regiment investigate? Why doesn't the division investigate? Why doesn't the MEF investigate?
Well, the way I break it down is the battalion didn't investigate because the battalion was likely afraid of the answers they might get, and they would the battalion. I'm talking about the battalion commander, I believe, would rather have thought of this as an unfortunate but good day in combat, rather than to imagine that his Marines would have done the wrong thing. I don't think necessarily he was motivated by avoiding responsibility himself, but I think that he, again, we started off this conversation by talking about how the Marines anticipated all this danger and all these insurgent attacks like constantly. And they needed to be hard. Well, he's the guy who told them to be hard.
Right.
And so here they're hard on the day. And I think that, he wanted to see the big picture. By the way, the battalion commander never went down there and walked the ground. He never did any kind of battle damage assessment, at all himself. He could have gone through the houses and seen what the Marines saw. And maybe that would have caused him to call for an investigation, but I think he just relied on reports, and maybe he was a guy who you didn't want to bring bad news to, and so therefore he had a positive impression of it, and I think he reported it in a positive way to the regiment and to the division. So I think to a certain extent, the fact that true facts weren't collected and analyzed and known by the battalion commander. I think the regiment and the division may have been persuaded that there wasn't a need. I mean, and at this point, I'm just speculating.
So as it travels, as this incident travels north, the narrative is, and I won't ask you to suppose, from your recollection of the different testimonies and things that you saw, as this news traveled north from the battalion to RCT2, to 2nd Marine Division, to 2MEF, what was the narrative?
Well, I think the narrative, and I haven't seen the documents that reported this, but I believe the narrative was an IED exploded, killed a Marine, wounded two others. Marines defended themselves, took fire, cleared houses, and in the course of clearing houses, you know, looking for the insurgents, some civilians died. And that's just it's kind of a general paraphrasing of it, but I think that was the narrative that went up.
Okay.
And
the actual scene.
I'm not absolving higher leaders of their responsibility to ask for more information or to direct an investigation anyway. I think that still existed.
Right. The SIG event that was published, I think, if I'm not mistaken, says that was this a SIG event or an explanation that I saw that said 15 civilians were killed when a roadside bomb detonated?
It was a press release.
Okay.
It was a press release by the division public affairs officer, a captain, that said an IED exploded in Haditha, killing 15 civilians along with killing one Marine and injuring two other Marines, not necessarily in those words, but you were left with the unmistakable conclusion after reading the paragraph press release that the civilians were killed in the IED blast, which was completely false.
Do you have any idea where that narrative comes from?
Yes. Yes, I know exactly where it came from because that captain told investigators where it came from. He made it up. He made it up because he didn't want the insurgents to use it as propaganda. He didn't want the insurgents to use the fact that Marines had actually killed civilians in clearing the houses as propaganda against coalition forces or against the Marine Corps.
And he made that statement. So he made that statement.
And he made it up.
And he made that statement.
No one reported that to him. He said, that's the information I put out to keep the truth from being used as propaganda against us.
Okay.
Which to me is just indefensible.
So we continue on this in internal phase. So you have a battalion commander, by your measure, believes that this is the collateral damage and does not even go down there. And then the division, I guess, would echo the sentiment of the battalion commander and say, yeah, you know, I mean, you know, he says that it's nothing out of the ordinary, so we take him at his word. And so nobody at either the division level or the MEF level says, yeah, look, I don't care what the explanation is. We need to make sure we go down there and take a look.
That's true, and we know that. We know that what you just said to be true, that no one intervened in a way that they should. Because several very senior staff officers and commanders were censured, which is a written ass chewing basically, right, by the Secretary of the Navy. So people were relieved and people were censured by the Secretary of the Navy for not investigating, regardless of what information they had or false or true information, for not ordering an investigation. So what you're the point you're making here that an investigation was not done and should have been was recognized by senior Department of the Navy leadership, and those folks lost their jobs and their careers.
And that was done after in the SecNav's review, after everything was adjudicated?
No, it was done. It was done during the course of our Haditha case, our Sessor and Wittershus Haditha case, six years. Those things happened, I would say, within a year of everything getting sorted out.
Wow. Okay, anything about that internal phase? Because, honestly, that's a bit of a head-scratcher. Where did the pictures go that the HET team Marine took? Where do they go?
Well, he uploads them into a file in his computer, and they go nowhere. Nobody within 3-1 asks for them, asks to, you know, hey, Lance Corporal, can you give me those pictures? You know, we need those now. Now's the time to do an investigation. You know, we've already talked about there was no investigation. No one inquires about those photos at all for any reason for, until NCIS gets involved. Until NCIS gets involved in the investigation sometime in 2006, they come asking them for them.
Okay.
Nobody in 3-1 does, though.
Okay, so those pictures go nowhere. Okay, that takes us to phase four. The first part of phase four is charges. We're in phase four. So tell me what happens when the Time article is published. In the Documentary House, too, I think they do a great job in kind of showing you how the Time article comes about by chance. Watch the speech President Bush gives. Here's a number of 30,000 civilians have been killed. Says, wow, that's a high number. I'd like to look into that. Doesn't want to be with embedded American troops when he looks into it. Winds up looking for an NGO that's in Iraq doing good stuff that he can embed himself with. Winds up crossing paths with a circus and somebody involved, the owner of the circus, the guy who runs the circus, says, offers him this videotape. And the videotape then spawns the beginning of his investigation, and it's in his investigation where he queries 2nd Marine Division and 2 MEF PAOs about this incident. Neil, talk about those emails. The emails are pretty dismissive. Doesn't one of the PAOs says, I can't believe that you're buying into this bullshit or something like that?
Yes. So the division, I guess at the division level, or perhaps even the mess level, they convinced themselves that there was no there. So when they perceive I'll just make this up, some kind of anti-war Time magazine reporter wanting to make something of it that they didn't want made of it, they tried to say that there was. That there was no there. They tried to tell him that there's, you know, move along, nothing to see. And to the extent that you're believing these Iraqi stories that there was a massacre there, or that people were gunned down by Marines, that just didn't happen. So there was a back and forth between the reporter trying to get access, trying to go to where the Marines were. And interview them and maybe, you know, do his own kind of investigative journalism, investigative reporting. And, he ultimately didn't go at all. He had scheduled a visit at 3-1, but he didn't go because the tactical situation changed and became too dangerous. At least that's what he says.
Okay.
So he never had access to it. But so he goes ahead and he writes this report based on information he has, a little bit unfairly because it doesn't have Marine Corps input from people who know anything. It just has the official lines, but to the extent though that it gets published, it gets national media attention. And once it gets national media attention, then the switch gets flipped, and an Army colonel is sent down to 3-1 to do an administrative investigation, just a preliminary inquiry, a you know, a senior commander sends a colonel down, and the colonel sits Marines down with, he's got a lawyer with him, and he's got somebody taking notes, and he's telling the Marines, you know, tell me what happened on that day. And one by one, you know, he's reading them their rights, and they're talking, and so Sessler and Witter talk to them, all the Marines talk to him, because they just were told they, you know, need to talk to the guy. And once he's done, he recommends that there be a criminal investigation. He says, hey, you know, this has gone beyond my level of capability to, you know, figure out who did what to whom. I recommend you bring in a CIS in. And then that's what the Marine Corps did. They called in CIS and launched the investigation, I want to say late February, early March of 2006.
All right. The article is called Collateral Damage or Civilian Massacre in Haditha? It's written by Tim McGurk. It was published in Time magazine on Sunday, March 19th, 2006. So that happens. You were just talking about the investigation. The investigation that you're discussing, how is it referred to? What's the name of it?
It's called the Bargewell Investigation. The Bargewell Investigation.
All right, and that is done. General Petraeus sets that in motion?
I think so. Yeah, somebody or somebody acting for him. Yes.
Okay. And I think it's spelled what? B-A-R-G-W-E-L-L?
B-A-R-G-E-W-E-L-L.
Okay. All right. Is that something that's readily available on the internet? I mean, can people search on that?
I got to believe it's out there somewhere. I mean, I haven't looked for it myself. You know, we got it as part of our discovery for the case, you know, from the government, but, And so we had all those statements from the Marines, and then we also had a lot of statements from NCIS from the Marines, and that's how we began to piece together what happened.
Got it. All right, so NCIS gets involved. Tell me, walk me through, so NCIS gets involved in the spring of 2006. What is their investigation consist of, considering, you know, that the event happens almost, four and two, almost 6 months previous to them getting involved?
Well, the first thing they do is they call on their two best CSI type guys, if you will, from TV. They're forensic experts. So guys who chase down drug dealers. They're guys who go to crime scenes and collect evidence and put together forensic reports of reconstructions of crimes. And they're the master's degree guys in criminology and in criminal science.
Okay.
So they call them from two places in the world, and they ship them off to Iraq, and then they set up an opportunity for them to. They give them all the photographs, and they give them all the statements, and they let them work with all that information. They actually send them out to the scene, but it's still a very dangerous area, so they have to get a big contingent of Marines to escort them out there. And they only give them I forget what one of them said about how many minutes they got to spend in all the locations, but it was just a matter of maybe an hour.
And now 3-1 is home by this time, yes?
Oh yeah, 3-1 is back in the States. They've finished their deployment, and so they go to these houses. They go to where the roadside was. They compare the photographs with what they see in the houses that have now been repaired, cleaned up. So the evidence that exists at a crime scene just wasn't there. It wasn't there at all, and the bodies were long buried, and there was going to be no exhumation of the bodies to re-examine them. So they were severely handicapped in what they could determine because it was all going to be based on accounts from Marines and photographs and whatever little they could find with their site visit.
Got it. So at what point by the time NCIS begins their investigation, have you already been hired by Stetson Woodridge?
About that immediately
time?
Thereafter.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, it was about the same time because somebody who was looking out for him said, "Hey, Waters, you need to get a lawyer because NCIS is coming." And so I was able to actually be hired by him and talk to him before NCIS showed up. So he never he never talked to NCIS. He just asserted his right to remain silent.
Got it. Statements were made, though, before Marines of Kilo Company left Haditha because, you know, I'm hearing, you know, statements like I was kept in the dam for, you know, for 14 hours, isolated by was that NCIS? Was that local? Was that agents in country that went up there that took initial statements? Who does that?
Those I believe were either agents who were already in country or agents who had gotten there pretty quickly once they decided that they needed an NCIS investigation.
Okay. All right. And can you describe those in interrogations, those interviews, however you would care to describe what happened when they were interviewed by NCIS?
Well, so guys were, you know, I think just about everybody talked to NCIS except Cesar Woodrich, and they expressed various levels of cooperation, I would say. But the NCIS agents were pretty relentless. I mean, it was pretty clear that they knew that bad things had happened at the hands of these Marines, and they wanted to get to the bottom of it. So they spent a lot of time with the Marines until they got something that they felt like was concrete and usable enough before they quit. And I think one Marine, it's actually documented in the records. It's not just his story. He spent 14 hours under continuous interrogation in the basement of the Haditha Dam. Not very much light, and wasn't even allowed to leave the room to urinate. He had to pee in a bottle, and it's a pretty barbaric sort of treatment, I think. I mean, you want to give guys breaks from time to time, because then you start to question whether what they say is accurate or voluntary. If it looks like that they were treated too badly. I mean, nobody was beaten or anything like that. I mean, that doesn't happen anymore. But anyway.
That's where the initial statements that are made to NCIS come from. Agents in country go out there and they sit down with Marines and they begin to, and the Marines begin to tell their story.
Right. And as you can imagine, now we're in late February, early March.
Okay.
And the event happens on 19 November of the previous year.
Okay.
So a lot of time has passed, and that's another bad thing. You know, people's memories are different. People may have talked about things. People may have said, well, let's make sure we got our stories straight, or worse yet, they may not have talked about getting their story straight. And so you end up with lots of different recollections about what happened, either true or not true.
Got it. So and then culminating in this third phase, as we kind of walk through it today, are charges. Charges are brought against how many Marines, and what are the charges range from?
So 8 Marines are charged initially in just before Christmas in 2006. So there are 4 officers and there are 4 enlisted Marines charged.
Okay.
The four enlisted Marines their charges are associated with shooting, the combat action that happened that day. The 4 officers were charged with sort of collateral kinds of crimes like dereliction of duty for failure to accurately report the events of the day, dereliction of duty for failure to investigate. One lieutenant had a charge of mishandling classified information that was just, you know, that was sort of loosely related to the case, but they found classified material on his computer or something like that. So it was basically combat-related offenses and after-the-fact type offenses for the officers.
Got it. So that's where we sit at the end of phase 3. And so the 4 Marines that are charged in the shooting part of it, in the kinetic part of it, are who?
They are Staff Sergeant Woodrich. They are Lance Corporal Tatum, Lance Corporal Sherritt, and Lance Corporal De La Cruz.
Okay. And so talk about, if you would, in those charges that will become instrumental in your case, what is each one, where do you want to start, and can you just tell me the charges that are levied against each one?
Yeah, generally speaking, so Lance Corporal Sherritt was charged only in connection with the four deaths in House 4, military age males in House 4. Those were his only charges.
Okay.
Lance Corporal De La Cruz was charged only with the deaths of the five military age males at the white car that showed up after the IED. That site was called Roadside, or that okay. group of charges was referred to as Roadside. And then Lance Corporal Tatum and Cesar Woodrich were both charged with deaths. So let me start with Lance Corporal Tatum. Lance Corporal Tatum was charged with deaths associated with shooting in House 1 and House 2. And then Cesar Woodrich was charged with deaths that occurred in all those locations. And the nature of the charges for Cesar and Woodrich were unpremeditated murder.
Unpremeditated murder.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Next question for you. Well, I guess that ends phase. Anything else about this phase from the Time article to the when this thing goes external, NCIS, the Bardswell investigation, and that culminates in charges being levied on four enlisted Marines and four officers?
Well, I think one salient event now that it's gone external is that the Marine Corps figures out that this is a very complex case and a very serious case and absolutely impacts the image of the Marine Corps when you get branded as, killing in cold blood, as Congressman John Murtha said publicly. In the Time magazine article and so forth, and all the coverage was talking about the Aditha massacre. It was known by no other name other than the Aditha massacre. They assembled a team of prosecutors. Crack experienced people who were going to be brought together and work as a team to sort through not only this case, but another case that often gets confused with this one, which occurred at Hamdaniya. So Marines were accused of killing an individual man in Hamdaniya. And interestingly, there were, I think there were eight Marines charged there too. But the two events were unrelated. They happened at different times with different units and different circumstances. But this giant prosecution team was assembled looking for talent throughout the Marine Corps among lawyers and assistant lawyers to manage those two cases.
And just to paint the picture for everybody, so the Time magazine article happens in, March of, March of 2006.
Yes.
The Hamdaniya thing happens in 2006 as well, and in outside of Fallujah, between Fallujah and Baghdad, and so that comes to market not at the same time, but not too long afterwards, it comes to market as well, and so okay. So the relative to the next phase is charges. And immunity. One person that isn't charged is somebody who's involved in House 2, and that is his PFC Mendoza. Yes.
Yes. Yes. So PFC Mendoza was a shooter that day. He was one of the initial squad members who went with Western Waters to clear the houses, and so he went through House 1 and he went through House 2. He was not involved in Roadside or House 4, the other places where deaths occurred. But he was there, and he said, and he admitted in his statement, killing Iraqis in both in House 1 and House 2. So he was there. He was the most junior member of the squad, the boot, if you will, the boot. And, And the prosecution, the lawyers who managed this prosecution team, elected not to charge him. Perhaps because he was the junior member, and perhaps because in all of his statements, whenever he's firing his weapon at a human being, he takes the position, or he says that he was told to do that by somebody superior to him in the chain of command.
Okay, and so that's Mendoza. He's significant,
right?
But not charged. All right, let's talk about the next part of this, I want to talk kind of the initial strategy from you as you begin to receive pieces of the investigation, and also then the prosecution, the way they use immunity to try to make sense of that. When do you start getting information, and when does his defense, Cesar Wuerich's, because one of the things that is predominant in the documentary House 2 is his frustration when he says, "I simply don't recall, I can't," and you can imagine. So if you're going to rise to his defense, you know, this happens on November 19th,
right?
And now 6-7 months later, now I'm expected to go back and remember, and I've cleared a lot of other houses since then. I've been fighting here for the 7 months. Now I'm supposed to remember in high definition what I did that day. You see his you see his frustration. When you, as a defense counsel, did you buy that? Did you think he was protecting other people? As this thing begins to get pieces of it, what are your initial thoughts on the defense? And did you believe Cesar Wuerich in terms of, because I don't know. I don't know that there's a higher crime as a Marine in the fraternity of Marines than to turn on your subordinates or turn on your fellow Marines. It is, and in fact, we talk about the Hamdaniyeh thing. Huge in that is the specter of turning on your battle buddies. And I can remember vividly one of the quotes from a corporal: "You knew this was wrong. Why did you participate?" Well, I raised the question with my squad leader, and he looked at me and said, "What are you, a fucking pussy?" Now, I fought with these guys in Fallujah. They've saved my life. I've saved their life. And there's no way I could turn my back on them, so they gave me a lesser role. Okay, so, I mean, that's how, and this is not a pristine event. These are people that risk their lives for each other, so to turn your back on them is something, even when they're doing evil, is not something that Marines feel comfortable doing. And so, so it's interesting in retrospect. Even when you look at, I was watching some video about Mi Lai today, and the guy who's ultimately the whistleblower, I want to say probably 30 years after the event, is very solemn about it and talks about how difficult it was. These were my, but he's extremely clear for whatever reason. It was wrong, and there was no way I was going to be a part of it. And if I didn't raise this up, I would have been a part of it for the rest of my life. And yeah. So as you took this on, Neil, what were your thoughts as you began to get pieces of the investigation? And did you believe that he was being straight with you, or did you believe he was protecting other people?
Well, so and that happens in phases too. In this case, so this is a 6-year relationship, and I'm going to condense it down to in order to answer your question. My initial 2 days of interviews with him had me convinced, before we got a chance to really dig heavily into all the evidence, had me convinced that these were likely accidental killings. That Marines don't do this. Marines don't kill civilians.
Right.
At least not intentionally. I mean, we do accidentally. We do only when we can't avoid it. And my sense of things was based on the kind of person I assessed him to be, that one of two things could have happened. Either no crimes were committed, or at a minimum, my client didn't commit them. So that I was convinced of very, very early in the case.
Okay.
But as we began to drill down and talk to him more, and the fact that whenever we would ask him, relatively difficult questions or questions to dig more detail out of what happened at any particular site during the day, he professed to not be able to remember. And I can remember talking with my co-counsel on the case.
Okay, stop for a second.
Colby Vogt.
Yeah, will you stop and explain how the defense counsel set up? I probably should ask that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So whenever a service member is charged with a crime and is facing court-martial, he is assigned a military defense counsel. That happens in all the services. It's an absolute right. So it's like you get a public defender kind of. And that's the analogy. And so you don't have to hire a civilian counsel. Like you don't ever have to do that. People sometimes do, and that's their choice. But you get a counsel. But because these cases were so serious and the stakes were so high. I mean, before the charges came out, we didn't even know if the death penalty was going to be sought or not, you know.
Right.
But what we did end up with was just below that level, and that is, you know, lots of charges on the charge sheet, each of which carries life imprisonment as a potential punishment. So a lot is at stake. Well, knowing that, the military defense team at Camp Pendleton assigned two military lawyers and even reached into the reserve community to come up with a couple of the counsel, actually called up reserve attorneys with experience to represent each of these Marines. So every Marine, including Spencer Woods, had two military attorneys. And all of them also, all of those attorneys also, I mean, all those Marines, those four Marines I told you originally charged, did hire civilian counsel.
Wow.
So each legal team had at least three lawyers on it.
Is that common?
No, it's very uncommon. The most common situation is you go to court martial facing charges against you with one military attorney. The next most common scenario would be if you have the funds and have the money to hire a civilian attorney to get a little bit more experience and maybe a stronger team, you hire a civilian attorney. It's very rare that you ever get assigned to you two military attorneys because resources are scarce. And they're just not manned at that level. Defense offices in the services are not manned at the level where they can afford to assign two counsel to even the serious cases. Again, it just rarely, rarely happens. Only in like death penalty type cases or very, very complex charges.
I don't want to get sidetracked by that, but this issue becomes an issue, doesn't it? Of the number of defense attorneys assigned to these Marines, doesn't that become an issue for Lieutenant Colonel Volke?
It becomes an issue for him in terms of manning, and that's why he needs to reach into the reserves. But Lieutenant Colonel Volke, I don't know if you're talking about having to retire at some point and kind of leaving the case, but...
I thought there was an issue... relative with the staff judge advocate of the Marine Corps, and I might not have the right term, but whoever's in charge of defense counsel in the Marine Corps took issue with that, saying it was excessive, and there was an issue because of it. Is that am I imagining things?
No, you're not imagining things. There was a time when Lieutenant Colonel Volke, who was the regional defense counsel, he was in charge of all the defense counsel on the west coast of the United States for the Marine Corps. His judgment was questioned by the chief defense counsel of the Marine Corps, a colonel, a full colonel. She questioned him doing that. I wasn't part of the interaction, but as a result of their interaction, she ended up relieving him of his duties, and because of the arguments they had, and it may have been more complex than what you and I are talking about. But when General Mattis, who was the convening authority at the time for the Haditha cases, Lieutenant General Mattis, found out that she had done that, he called somebody and basically required that Lieutenant Colonel Boakye be reinstated in his position, because he wasn't going to have, our understanding was that he wasn't going to have the Haditha cases jeopardized by some concerns about whether or not there was adequate representation for any of these Marines.
All right. The in terms of the next phase of this, as you can tell, one of the things my guest today is Neil Puckett, retired Marine Corps officer, part intel, part SJA in his career, the attorney for the civilian attorney at the time for Sergeant Woodruff during his Haditha court-martial. He's been gracious enough to spend some time with us and to walk through these events. And it's one of the challenging things is that there's a lot that obviously we could pull out and discuss relative to the Haditha case. And trying to manage it here. The next phase really is the in this thing, Neil, is plea deals and immunity. So before I get to that, your sense of what you had in front of you, did you believe that you were going to be able to exonerate Stefan Woodridge from the charges that he faced?
Yes and no. I always believed we were going to be able to exonerate him from the homicide charges, the murder charges that were later reduced to voluntary manslaughter charges when we finally got to trial. I always knew that because the forensic evidence supported his innocence, his non-involvement in the civilian deaths that occurred, or at least the questionable ones. There were some that were ruled legitimate. Legitimate combat actions. For instance, the deaths at roadside, the five military age males climbing out of the vehicle, the four military age males with two or three AK-47s between them in a room in House 4, those were ruled legitimate combat actions. So those were off the table. But the charge that was brought that I didn't mention before, because it was a lesser charge, with our client was charged with willful dereliction of duty, two counts of willful dereliction of duty for basically being in charge of this disaster that happened. I always understood that at the end of the day, at the end of a trial, members of a court-martial panel, who serve as the jurors in a court-martial panel, officers and enlisted members, would look at all these facts and say, well, you know, Cesar Woodridge, we in their deliberations would agree that he hadn't killed anybody unlawfully, and he hadn't directed anybody to kill anyone unlawfully. There was no evidence whatsoever of anything like that. But at the end of the day, I always believe that they were always going to see that as, well, you let things get out of control, and you were derelict in your duty, and your duty was to maintain tactical control of those Marines that day, and you failed to do that. And so, to this day, I will go to my grave saying there was no way that, and Special Wooders believes this too, by the way. He believes, that he was guilty of dereliction of duty and always wanted to plead guilty to dereliction of duty because he knew that he did not maintain control of his Marines.
You know, but that's tough. This is his first time. It's not easy. It's hard, right? And so, you know, hopefully.
It's very hard.
Hopefully your first time doesn't involve the things that are involved in Haditha, that you get a chance to learn a little bit before, you know, you're thrust into something greater. Okay. All right. That makes sense. I want to walk through the chronology of plea deals and immunities, because I think that I think as we go through this, you will begin to understand how this happened, or kind of where the what is left relative to the defense of Steph Sergeant Woodard. So, first plea deal. I guess the first one we should talk about is Mendoza because he's not charged, Jeff.
Yes, Mendoza's not charged at all. So he escapes scrutiny or accountability, individual accountability for anything he did that day because he was never charged and he was granted testimonial immunity. And what that means is if you're granted testimonial immunity, it means you have to testify if you're called to testify in a trial. You can't say, well, I refuse to answer on the grounds that it may incriminate me. I'm asserting my Article 31B rights. So it's basically a contract that says so long as you tell the truth every time you're asked questions, we're not going to use what you say or even what you did, what you say you did against you to prosecute you. So he got a good deal from the outset.
Okay, so he's a junior Marine. He represents in his statement that in his initial statements that everything he did at the behest of somebody senior to him, and then he's given so he's not charged and he's given testimonial immunity. Is there anything that can be done to Mendoza after that's he's granted that?
Well, in a very limited sense, yes. If it were later to be determined that he lied under oath, or lied even to investigators, if he lies in telling any of his stories, adverse action can be taken against him either criminally or administratively. Yes.
Okay. If he lies.
And if he lies, yeah.
So if he simply, no matter what the truth is, if he simply gets on the stand and tells the truth, there's nothing anybody can do to him in terms of dragging him back into this thing, charging him and prosecuting.
Well, not after. That's right. That's right.
Okay.
We can talk legal theory, and legal theory is, you know, at any point in the investigation or in the case, you know, so long as he's still on active duty, he can still be charged. So things could have been done against him, but as we sit here today,
okay, explain
nothing can be.
Okay, explain that to me because how does that? I don't understand that relative to testimonial immunity.
Okay, so we're talking, first of all, let's talk about jurisdiction. So as we talk here today, nothing can be done to a Marine by the Marine Corps if they've been separated from active duty. If they're no longer on active duty, then jurisdiction ends.
Okay.
Okay. But at the time, back when the case was still going on, I want to make this clear. When you're given testimonial immunity, it means that whenever you testify, your words cannot be used as evidence to create a case against you. Your words after you've been immunized cannot be used against you. So even if you get up on the witness stand and you admit to doing a crime as part of your obligation to testify, you admit that you did a crime, your admission to that crime cannot be played back in your own court martial against you because you've got testimonial immunity. Okay, but if during the course of giving your testimony you lie, your letter from the Canadian authority says, however, you're required to testify truthfully, and you're still liable for if you're untruthful, you're still liable for a prosecution for perjury or making a false official statement.
Okay,
so that's part of every immunity deal.
Okay, all right. Some of these Marines, their stories change after they receive immunity.
Yes.
Can you, before we talk about everybody else's, the plea bargains and the immunizations, so now what we have is we have the forensics reports, we have the statements from, the initial statements, and then everybody lawyers up, and then the Marines don't make any further statements, correct?
Right.
Okay. Right. So what the prosecution has to go on is their initial statements and NCIS. Do those things confirm each other? Is it confusing? Put on your prosecutor hat, if you would, for a second. The case the prosecution had, was it an easy case to prove, or was it difficult?
No, it was a very difficult case to prove, because now you've got these statements and you've got these positions that people have taken. And the problem in this case, without going into too much detail, is the Marines who were in a position to see things and do things gave different accounts of what happened. And to make matters worse, they weren't just different, they were conflicting. In other words, you have two Marines who were in, let's just pick an example, two Marines who were in House 2, who were, in there clearing the house or whatever, who give, diametrically opposed, versions of what happened and who went into the room where people were killed and what happened in that room. So in other words, if you believe one of them is telling the truth, the other one cannot be telling the truth. What he says cannot be true, and vice versa. But what made this trial, difficult for the prosecution is, they chose not to pick one or the other. They chose to put on the witness stand both of those statements. So it's kind of like hamstringing yourself or tying both hands behind your back. The problem is, so if one of those people, if one of those Marines says something opposite of the other one, the question for the jury or the members of the court martial is, what do I believe? Which of those things is true? And so they essentially, they don't cancel each other out, but they both call into question the other's credibility.
Right.
So now I'm going to go back to something you said earlier. Several Marines gave different versions of events as the investigation progressed. They would go back to them and they would give a different story, and then they testify and they'd give a different story. Lance Corporal Delacruz comes to mind. He changed his versions of what happened at the white car about the roadside event where the five military males showed up afterwards and were engaged. He gave at least five different versions of that story. And so when statements are inconsistent, it causes you to wonder, well, which one of those versions is true? Which one of those things happened? And there's actually an instruction that a military judge would give the jury to say, if you find the statements are inconsistent, it may cause you to wonder whether or not anything the witness said is truthful or a similar type of instruction. So the prosecution was, really in a bad spot in trying to not only use the one Marine, but use two or three Marines whose stories had changed and who contradict one another. It was almost an impossible task.
So between the conflicting statements and then the story that the forensics tell, and the forensics of it are composed purely on the images that were taken off the Het Marine's camera, because there is nothing else, yes?
Right, right.
The only, and exactly. And you're right.
Let's draw that into it too. So the additional problem is, we'll come back to the forensics. The forensics guys, so we're talking science now.
Right.
So a scientist gets up and says, my scientific evidence showed me that XYZ happened. And if the previous testimony had been that XYZ did not happen, or vice versa, what you've got is a jury hearing from a scientist that what the guy who just testified said cannot be true by the laws of physics, by the laws of nature, by visual evidence of wounds and so forth. It cannot be true. And the prosecution knew this. They knew that the forensic evidence contradicted much of the eyewitness testimony from the Marines. And yet that's kind of what they were stuck with, and that's what they decided to put on as evidence.
Got it. The okay, so when you look at the prosecution's case, They sat down and they look at this bowl of spaghetti that they have. Now, walk through the plea deals and the immunizations and make sense of that for us. Or you don't, maybe you're not the right person to make sense of it, but you're all we got. So help us understand that, because certainly the prosecution is in a difficult position. So they sit down, given our forensics evidence, given what we see in terms of statements, and I think at some point you have to bring the convening authority into the discussion, and that convening authority is General Mattis. And I want to read something that is in an article that was in Vanity Fair, written by Dexter Filkins, and I'll just read one paragraph. Mattis suggested that young fighters in difficult circumstances, moral concerns had to be balanced against the viability of the mission. Quote, you can't criminalize every mistake, unquote, he said. Quote, bad things happen in war. Don't get me wrong. Discipline is discipline, comma, close quotation, he added. And then quoted again. I sent two generals home over it. I ended a lieutenant colonel's career over it. And as it went down lower, I was not as harsh. He went on. You have to have a degree of humanity when you're given the authority to lock your own troops up in jail for the rest of their life because they have the guts to volunteer to go into that situation. In 2010, so now that's Mattis talking about his leaning relative to this case, and he doesn't speak publicly very often about it. I don't recall seeing him speak in detail about it. Maybe the most detail I've ever heard him speak about it. In 2010, Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus reprimanded the Marine Corps for not dealing more harshly with some of the men involved. Quote, I was stunned to learn these guys were still in the Marines, Mabus told me. And then this is Filkins retelling this. They had taken part in the murder and nothing had been done. Mabus, a civilian appointee, ordered them discharged. What happened in Hamdaniya and Haditha was part of a pattern, which is an interesting comment that we won't get into right now. But I just want to
let me put that in context a little bit for the folks listening. So sure. we earlier talked about the fact that PSC and later Sergeant Mendoza, by the time he testified in the court martial, it was proven that he had lied throughout about his testimony and actually was one of the shooters that killed the folks on the bed. I want to kind of bring us full circle here. It turns out, much to our disappointment, that Haditha really was a massacre, and that Marines really did murder civilians. It just wasn't Staff Sergeant Wooders who did it. And so to circle back to something else you said earlier, we talked about the letting people off. It appeared to us that the prosecution had early on formed a theory that Staff Sergeant Wooderich himself had sort of lost his mind or became so angry that he led his Marines, the word was rampage, led his Marines on a rampage and was directing killings and execution style killings of civilians. But we later discovered based on the forensic evidence that it was PSC Mendoza who was not charged. It was Lance Corporal Tatum who had his charges dismissed on the first day of his court-martial rather than face court-martial, so long as he agreed to testify in accordance with his statement against Staff Sergeant Wooderich. And Lance Corporal Sherritt, who, as we said before, was never charged for the deaths in House 1 and House 2, but had admitted in his statement that he went back to House 1 after it was cleared and killed people. fired his weapon, but that's when we determined that, you know, that the folks were killed in house one, not on the initial clearing, but after they finished house two. So what happens is, Lance Corporal Dela Cruz, who lied, giving five or six different versions of what happened at Roadside, where he was the guy almost solely responsible for killing the five guys there, and PFC, who was a sergeant by the time, and Sergeant Mendoza were both directed by the secretary to be separated from the Marine Corps because of their complicity in the killings and because of their lying on the witness stand. And what's hard for me to comprehend is how lawyers in the Marine Corps didn't urge commanding officers to take those kinds of actions before the Secretary of the Navy had to call it to the commandant's attention, because he didn't send it down to a command. He told General Amos, you separate these Marines. I was surprised to learn that, you know, about their behavior. To circle back to your question about how a convening authority is involved in all this. At the time that most of the immunities were given and the charge and most of the charges were dismissed against Marines who science now shows us and history shows us were responsible for these murders, Joe Mattis was the convening authority, and he must have received advice from prosecutors to do that in order to shore up the case or to try to save or salvage the dying case against Seth Sergeant Woodard, because there was never any direct or scientific evidence of Seth Sergeant Woodard's complicity in any of the deaths.
So the case against Staff Sergeant Woodrich is built on statements and not supported by NCIS. I mean that's where it comes from.
Right. It was built solely on the statements and the contradictory statements.
Right.
Because there were Marines who lied about Staff Sergeant Woodrich's involvement or what he did that day.
All right. So we've kind of walked through it partially, but if we could walk through it in kind of chronological order. So Mendoza is not charged. He's given testimonial immunity. Next to be immunized or have charges dropped is
Lance Corporal Dela Cruz. At the time, Lance Corporal Dela Cruz. Just within a few weeks after the charges were announced, and with no explanation, his charges just went away. Again, he was charged with killing the five military-age males at the roadside in the white car.
And his initial
his
statement, he says that Stetson Woodrich is the one that killed them, yes?
Right, right. He says Stetson Woodrich killed them all, just walked up and shot them all.
Okay. And then his charges are dropped and he's immunized.
And he's immunized, right.
Okay, so Dela Cruz goes away. Who's after that?
Right. Sheriff's, the next in order would be Lance Corporal Sherritt, because he was only charged with the killings in House 4, and those were determined to be lawful combat actions. And the interesting thing about Lance Corporal Sherritt is he was the only one who was carrying a 9mm pistol that day, and there were photographs taken by Marines of 9mm shell casings in the crime scene in House 1 and in the crime scene in House 2. So there was photographic evidence of 9mm shell casings, meaning 9mm pistol was fired in both those rooms, and he was never charged with those deaths. So he was the second to kind of walk free.
So he's never charged in those deaths, and the reconciliation of the forensics evidence, that would be a question. 9mm rounds in the bedroom, how did they get there? That's never resolved.
That's never resolved.
Okay. All right. All right. So next, so that's Sherritt. So Sherritt's never charged or in relative
Sherritt's
anything in the other bedroom.
Right. He's never charged with anything in
House 1 or 2.
In the 2. Right.
Okay. All right.
And then finally, as I mentioned, Lance Corporal Tatum gets his charges dropped on the first day of his trial when the prosecutor asks the civilian defense counsel, will your guy testify in accordance with his statement? He answers, yes, he will. And then he said, well, we don't have to do this. And then he, his charges are dropped by, on a recommendation to General Mattis.
Okay. And he's immunized as well.
Yes.
Okay. So in terms of the case now built against, Sergeant Woodridge, you have these conflicting statements and you have all these other Marines that have now been immunized, and you have the forensics involved in it. So tell me about your level of confidence now. These guys have all been immunized. They're all going to supposedly testify in accordance with their statements, and yet the NCIS forensics contradicts much of what they say. Where are you relative to your own confidence?
Well, relative to my own personal confidence, it's still very high because now I can sort of do jujitsu. I can use these scientists whose credibility and whose competence won't be questioned by the prosecution because they're offering them as their witnesses. They're the government guys, you know.
Right.
They're going to be able to testify that it was essentially they're going to be able to provide the evidence to allow me to prove, which defense almost never does, prove that my client was not in the back bedroom at House 2 where all the questionable deaths occurred. And so that gets us out of jeopardy. I mean, the roadside killings were never going to be an issue. House 1 seems to have been a lawful engagement, and we're going to be able to demonstrate that the guys who weren't looked at hard enough were the guys who were responsible for those deaths.
And you
can be held accountable for those deaths.
And, well, they can't be held accountable, right, because they're immunized.
Well, right, but that's part of the injustice part of the case is that, you know, they were also able to leverage the fact that they were never really closely scrutinized for those things, and that's going to throw an extra factor into the mind of a juror that, hey, we've got the wrong guy here. Why aren't we sitting in a court martial for these other guys?
Okay, so at this point, your client is still charged with murder. Yes.
At this point, he's as a result of an Article 32 investigation, his charges were reduced from murder to voluntary manslaughter.
Okay. So how many charges of voluntary manslaughter?
Roughly the same number. They've just reduced the seriousness of them.
Okay.
But he's still looking at life in prison.
Right. Well, he could get life in prison. Well, could he get life in prison on one? On one charge?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think so.
And again, forgive my mind, but how many charges of voluntary manslaughter?
I want to say that. Well, no. So we had four removed. I want to say maybe 13 or 14.
Okay. All right. So now what year are we talking about when those charges are downgraded?
That happens, I want to say 2007.
2007. He ultimately will not go to trial for another 4.5 to 5 years. So
yes.
What is becoming of Staff Sergeant Woodridge in this period of time? Does he do anything gainful in the Marine Corps? Does he sit at home? What is becoming of him as this thing continues to wind its way down the crooked road of military justice?
Well, he's put in sort of menial jobs. I think for the bulk of that time, he was like a barracks manager at Camp Pendleton.
Okay.
Kind of a housing manager, but definitely not in his MOS and not really gainful. I mean, he wasn't sitting at home and he was never jailed. I mean, there was no, these guys were never in pretrial confinement, so there was never that issue.
Okay. And he goes through a divorce during this period?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
okay. Why does it take almost 5 years to bring this case to trial?
Well, without going into a lot of legal detail, there were four significant legal issues, four rounds of litigation on significant pretrial issues, one having to do with the media. My client and I went on 60 Minutes and talked right. about the case, and the prosecution tried to get that, tried to get the part of the interviews that were not aired to see if they might be able to mine any data from that, might get any admissions from him. There were a couple of years, I think, that went by on appellate litigation and the appellate courts and all the way up to the Supreme Court. And then there was the other issue of our senior military counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Colby Vokey, was due to retire. And we asked the Marine Corps to hold up on his retirement, and that was denied. And so by the time we actually started litigating towards trial, we attempted to litigate a denial of a right to counsel type motion, and there were a couple of rounds of that. So it takes time for those issues to be litigated in the appellate courts. And so a good 4 years of time was spent on, and in the meantime, when those issues are awaiting resolution on appeal, the court martial is put on hold. The clock right. isn't ticking.
Right.
And so the military judge is told to just stand down.
Got it. I'm going to ask you one question, and then we'll take a quick break, and we'll continue. My guest, very graciously, Neil Puckett. We're talking about the court martial of Staff Sergeant Frank Witterich and the Haditha event, so prominent in the history of the Iraq War. 60 Minutes, there was much written. There was many defense attorneys who came out and said, why would he allow his client to do this? So straight from the horse's mouth, why did it make sense for you to allow your client to go on 60 Minutes? I'm not sure that he vented his spleen, but why would you allow him to do that before the trial and not after?
Well, the primary reason is because of the way the military justice system is designed. So the discretion that a convening authority has as to whether or not to send a case to a court martial is unfettered. It's unrestricted. It's his decision. You know, it's the commanding general's decision of whether to send a case to court. I was building a case at that time of innocence for my client. I was building a case involving his training of his men and the discipline of the Marine Corps and the basically the unlikelihood of anything criminal happening among well-trained and well-supervised and well-disciplined Marines. I spent a lot of time with him talking about it. I spent a lot of time prepping him for these questions. And my appeal was to the Marine Corps, basically. My hope was that senior Marine leaders, not just General Mattis, but you know, all the way up to the Commandant, would see this and be influenced by it to not send the case to court-martial, either on their own or in result to overwhelming public appeal, if you will, to the Marine Corps. I'd had some successes in the past with media coverage of cases. Two cases I did, both with General Janice Karpinski, the commander of Abu Ghraib, was my client,
right.
as was then Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, Army Lieutenant Colonel, who was accused of detainee abuse in Iraq. We did an Article 32 investigation, but he didn't face court-martial, and the public outcry and support of his case, and even a long list of congressmen signed a letter to the Army asking that he not be prosecuted. Those kind of public appeals for not just sympathy, but for empathy with a very young-looking, big doe-eyed, fine-looking young man, good Marine Corps haircut, family man, talking about the challenges he faced that day. I was quite frankly putting pressure on the Marine Corps not to proceed with the case. And it, long shot, yes. Did I expect it to fully succeed? No, but you know, in a case this important, if you have to throw a Hail Mary, you you need to, or if you should, if a Hail Mary might can save your case, you have to strongly consider whether or not to do it. The risks were low. He did slightly contradict one of his statements that he had made earlier, and that was a risk I was willing to take if we could win the game. If we could win the game without showing up on the playing field, that was the idea. Very controversial. Not something I would do very, very easily or quickly again. Not something I would refuse to do in every case. But, I will tell you, most attorneys are risk averse, not willing to put, not willing to risk adverse consequences to try something that might help. They're very conservative in that regard. But, this was not a conservative move. It was a calculated risk. It wasn't perfect, but the story has a good ending, and that is the deputy staff judge advocate in the case saw the video, saw all the outtakes, saw all the interviews with Scott Pelley and Seth Sergeant Woodridge, and came to me during the trial and said, "Well, I wish I'd have seen this because it's pretty clear to me that your guy's not guilty."
Wow.
And we got some feedback from the jury too. One of our legal team members, and I forget who, we got some feedback from the jury kind of afterwards that they were very favorably impressed with the way he presented himself on the film that they were watching. And what it does is it gives him an opportunity, and this is the other sort of legal technical benefit. It gives, if you know the prosecution is going to show it because they think it helps their case, your client gets an opportunity to tell a version of his story and then not have to testify and not have to risk cross-examination himself. So there were lots of upsides to it. There were definitely some risks, and there will be some people who will see the film, the House 2 film, and say, "Well, that fucking guy was crazy I'd never let my client go on 60 minutes."
Right.
Other attorneys have. I wouldn't be the first, and I won't be the last. But, you know, my overall impression of it was I knew that Scott Pelley was going to only air, his hardest, toughest questions, and that's what he did air, and Sessler Woodridge came off looking pretty good. Not perfect, but pretty good.
All right. My guest, Neil Puckett. We're going to continue. The next part of this, there's two parts left that we'll do, is the court-martial itself of Seth Sergeant Woodridge and then the lessons learned. So don't go away. More of this interview about Haditha. What should you take away from it? What are the lessons to be learned from retired Marine officer Neil Puckett? More of this on All Marine Radio coming up next.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Mac, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue. Now, just look at the length of the interview. It's already 2 hours long. And to be honest with you, it feels like Neil and I have been talking for about 20 minutes. The subject matter, in my opinion, if you're a leader, if you've gone anywhere near a battlefield, the subject matter is riveting because this is what leaders have to be up for if they're going to lead in combat. It has to occur to you. Somebody has to tell you that something might go wrong, and when it goes wrong, this is what you ought to do. And so it's in the name of that, it's in the spirit of that endeavor that Neil and I spoke, wanted to do this together. And so, again, it's offered to you for your education, for your review, and your questions. So, and don't be afraid if you have any questions, you can shoot them to me here, mac.allmarineradio@gmail.com. You can find that on the website as well. Neil, the trial, gets ready, to start ultimately, what, in January of 2012. Yes. And so going into that with everything that had happened, are you confident that Stetson Woodridge is not going to be convicted of the charges that have been levied against him?
I'm supremely confident, with the exception that we mentioned earlier of we were going to get gauged for dereliction of duty no matter what.
Okay. Had you ever offered them any kind of deal, proposed a deal based on a dereliction of duty charge?
Yes, twice before. 2 years before we went to trial, I talked with Cesar Woodridge. He was amenable to offering to plead guilty to dereliction of duty for losing control of the Marines that day. He had taken the position from the very beginning of the case that he was responsible. He felt he was, as a Marine leader, responsible for what his guys did. And he couldn't be moved off that position. So in that spirit, I offered to the government to, plead guilty, to dereliction of duty, 2 years before. And then I tried it again a year before, like a full year before. I approached the chief prosecutor again and I said, hey, we don't have to do this. We don't have to, air the Marine Corps dirty laundry. He'll plead guilty to dereliction of duty and we can just move on. And got some initial support for that, but it didn't really go anywhere. So that brings us up to the beginning of the trial.
I have one question that popped in my head as you were talking. When I looked at, after watching the documentary House 2 and listening to the NCIS agents, I would not want to have been a prosecutor or part of the prosecution team knowing that you were going to break off the forensics evidence provided by my investigator in my ass in public.
Right.
do you, in retrospect,
hold that thought. Okay. That'll come back. Okay. We'll come back to that.
All right. All right. Talk to us how the talk to us how the trial unfolds. Does because this is small world stuff. But my ops chief was sat on the jury, Messer Ernest Cardenas. He deployed to Iraq.
I remember him.
He deployed to Iraq.
Yeah, I remember him.
As a platoon sergeant, as a company gunnery sergeant. And the guys on that jury were pretty highly decorated, pretty experienced guys that I'm sure that you all thought could hear this kind of evidence, put it in the context, and render a partial verdict. Later on, after the plea deal, when we discussed it, he talked about how confusing the testimony was. And he said, sir, he said, you know, that these guys wrote statements and then their cases were dealt with. They were given immunity. Then they changed their statements. Talk to us about how the prosecution's case unfolded and can you weave that in for us about how the statements that during the court martial were different than that which they had agreed to testify previously?
Well, so it unfolded as we anticipated. So one by one, the prosecution. So the prosecution in a case in a criminal case gets to present their case first, and then the defense gets to present a case if they want to present a case. So it always starts with the prosecution. So one by one, these Marines and we had scientists, not the NCIS guys yet. We had the forensic medical examiner and somebody else who was a forensic expert to back her up. But one by one, the Marines came into the courtroom. They swore to tell the truth, and some of them were background information about the training that was received. But some of them were the Marines who were, you know, had been facing charges that day, and other Marines in the platoon who had some information. Their testimony was presented. They were cross-examined by the defense, and we were winning every round. We were destroying the credibility of each and every Marine who purportedly was giving damaging information, but we've already covered a lot of that ground in this interview already as to
right.
who those people were and the kinds of things they said without being too specific. So we had all those earlier statements. They can be asked about those earlier statements, and like Master Sergeant Cardenas told you, you hear them say one thing, and then you hear that they had said other things on previous occasions, and we even got a couple of them to admit that they had fabricated earlier statements, but today what they were saying is true. You know, I made up all those things, all those different times I talked, but today, Della Cruz said, but today, but after that point, I decided I was going to tell the truth. Well, you know, if you hear somebody say that, you got a sergeant in the Marine Corps who says he's been lying under oath all these years, and you know he got his, all his charges dropped.
Right.
Well, what are you going to believe, right? So this went on witness after witness after witness, and Haytham Faraj was handling all the tactical aspects, and because he had been an infantry officer in a prior life in the Marine Corps, and was just decimating these guys. He was destroying them. I handled the science guys and was going to be cross-examining the forensic NCIS guys. They were getting nowhere. So this went on week after week after week. So we were in trial for a full 3 weeks, three work weeks, possibly even one Saturday, but I think it was just Monday through Friday, across 3 weeks. And, during a break in the case, we take breaks to go make head calls and things like that. During a break in the case, the chief prosecutor, came up to me in the hallway and he said, "Man, you guys are just killing us. You're just killing us. You know, you and Haytham are, you're just killing our guys." And I looked at him and I said, you know, this didn't have to happen. You remember a year ago and 2 years ago when I offered you a pretrial agreement, a plea bargain, and you said, no, you didn't want to do that? All of this was unnecessary. You know, we didn't have to do this. And then he says, "Oh, wait a minute, come here." he pulls me into the library, which is another room in the same hallway where the courtroom is. And he says, Neil, would your guy be willing to plead guilty to dereliction of duty if we drop all the other charges? And I said, well, Sean, that's what we've been talking about for 2 years now. And now you're just coming and telling me that this is doable. He goes, yeah, I think I could sell that to the convening authority. And I said, well, you know, it has to be, we have to work out the details, but provided that, you know, that's what we can get. You know, first of all, that particular charge doesn't authorize a discharge from the Marine Corps. That's not even an authorized punishment. And I said, you know, my bottom line here is, my guy doesn't get a discharge and my guy doesn't go to jail, then we're all in on that. So I think the maximum punishment was something like 3 months of confinement or something like that. And no homicide charges, right? All homicide charges get dropped.
Right.
So he sort of runs with that. And it takes several days now. I mean, this is not something that happens immediately, but we put the trial on hold while we negotiate the language of all this, and we try to sell it to General Waldhauser at the time, the subsequent convening authority, because as you mentioned, the case lasted 6 years.
Right.
And his first inclination was, you know, everybody's behind this, but his first inclination was, I hear from the deputy SJ, well, the general's not going to approve it. He wants the trial to continue. So I made some arguments and I said, well, you know, I don't think that's in the Marine Corps' best interest. Here's all the bad things that can happen. Public's going to find out about these guys who murdered people and you let them go and, you let them walk and it's not going to be good. I said, it's not going to be good in the national press. It's not going to be good in the international press. So we had that conversation and, it's like a call back from the SJA.
Neil, when you said that, did he know that he was gonna? Did he know that it was going? That this was going to be essentially, as I said before, broken off in the Marine Corps' ass in public? Did he know that?
I told him that in exactly that, not exactly that kind of language, but language very similar blunt. To that. I said, you know, this doesn't happen. I said, regardless of the outcome of this court martial, I'm holding a press conference and I'm showing the cards and I'm showing how. My guy gets convicted for, you know, whatever it's going to be, or he doesn't get convicted. I said, either way, I'm going to the international media and I'm blowing the whistle to say, here are the guys responsible for killing women and children in Haditha, and you guys decided to let them walk. They didn't go to court martial and get found not guilty. You guys decided to let them walk, knowing what you know about them. And I don't know if that influenced his decision, but. It was kind of a threat, if you will, but at that point it was like, hey, my guy's been taking the heat for everybody else, has kept his own counsel within himself, absolutely refused at every turn to give us information against any of the other Marines. You know, he never told his lawyers, hey, this guy did this and this guy did that. He was loyal to his Marines throughout the whole process. You know, he eventually, some of his memory returned, if you will, and he was able to confirm some of the things that the evidence already, that we already knew from the evidence. But here we have a 6 year, the most expensive case in military history, the longest case in military history, not just the Marine Corps. All this effort being applied to put my guy in jail, and the prosecutor comes to me and says, hey, we want to give your guy a deal. You know, if your guy will plead guilty to negligent dereliction of duty, we can just end this. And here's the punchline. He did that right before the next witness was going to be the first of the two NCIS agents who did all the forensics and who were going to blow the case up and basically tell the jury that our scientific evidence doesn't support what these Marines have just told you.
So these Marines who have switched their stories,
who point the finger at Death Sergeant Woodridge,
okay,
were not only lying about it, but they're the guys who were the perpetrators.
Okay, so and so they made false official statements originally. They were given plea deals based on their false official statements and the story that was created out of those statements. Not only plea deals and immunized all of them. And then subsequent to that, they changed their stories. And that was the case that was brought against. And then those stories were contradicted by the forensic case. And then essentially the plea deal gives the Marine Corps a way to get out of this and avoid really the humiliation of seeing
of the
it
truth.
Of the truth getting blown up in their face.
Right. It allows them to end the trial with somebody holding the bag, even though it's a very small bag. It's a very small minor punishment and a very small minor offense, bringing the whole matter to a close without ever letting the press report. And the press was present in the courtroom. Letting the press report this damnable forensic evidence that totally destroyed the prosecution narrative, which was Staff Sergeant Woodridge was responsible for all those deaths because he led his Marines on a rampage. Which, by the way, if you think about it, gets the Marine Corps off the hook. If that's true, if Staff Sergeant Woodridge had done that, then that absolves the Marine Corps and Marine Corps training and the Marine Corps image from any responsibility because this guy went off the reservation. He didn't do Marine things.
Right.
He did his own thing.
Right.
So that was always the theory. Always the theory was Staff Sergeant Woodridge led his Marines astray. Now, they shouldn't have allowed themselves to be led astray, you could say. But the best narrative for the Marine Corps coming out of Haditha was this – none of what happened was consistent with Marine Corps doctrine, training, ethos, morality, honor. We didn't fail to keep our honor clean. One rogue agent did this, and it's therefore can't be hung on us.
Got it. Talk to us about you guys. The plea deal is all put together, and then talk to us. So he gets a general discharge. What the hell is a general discharge?
So the result of the trial was Staff Sergeant Woodridge, because of his plea, gets convicted. He gets convicted of a crime. It's obviously a very minor crime, dereliction of duty, but it's, in any case, it's a crime. He's got a court-martial conviction, so therefore, the Marine Corps can, he's passed his EAS, by the way. So he can't be held past his EAS to go through an administrative separation board, but they can give him a general under honorable conditions discharge, which means he gets all of his VA benefits with the exception of the GI Bill. So an honorable discharge is the best discharge. A general under honorable conditions discharge is the second level, and the only difference between the two are the GI Bill benefits, okay? And the third type of administrative discharge is an other than honorable discharge. And if you get that, you get no veterans benefits at all.
Okay.
So they give him, I mean, they could have given him an honorable discharge, but I don't think that would have, they could have justified that to themselves or to the world that, you know, the guy at Haditha gets an honorable discharge. If you compare that to what could have happened to him, if he would have been convicted of 18 counts of murder or voluntary manslaughter, he wouldn't be getting, he would be getting probably a dishonorable discharge. Right?
No, I'll tell you what, it's very, in the documentary House 2, it's a pretty riveting moment in the documentary where you're talking to him about the plea deal. And it's almost like there's an element of disbelief in the air. Like they're going to agree to this.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like that's it.
And right. with you saying yes, they've agreed to this. And so it's riveting television to say the least. That kind of human drama comes to a moment of resolution. And so I want to go to lessons learned after I ask you one question. Can you walk us through to the best of your knowledge? What was the truth that day? What happened?
Well, in abbreviated form, it roughly traces what I told you in our earlier interview, and that is that a terrible IED took the life of a young Marine and injured two others, and after that, Marines going in pursuit of a shooter cleared a house, I believe lawfully on the first pass through, went in, I'll use the term hot pursuit of a runner, into house two, breached house two again properly, a guy where we believe an insurgent may be inside, a guy in a dark right. clothing shows up at the door.
And he's the grandfather, yes?
Who appears
near that door, and he's shot.
Yes.
And again, I think this goes, and I want to take this full circle.
Wrong place at the wrong time.
Okay.
Wrong place at the wrong time.
But these guys, there had been shots fired, and their platoon commander, who's never been in combat before either, he says clear those houses. Clear in the
right.
context of Mojave Viper,
right.
in terms of their training. And I'm not trying to give anybody a cop out. I'm just saying this is the way they were trained was
yes.
they're going to go in and they're going to clear the house. Now, okay. So Mendoza shoots the elderly man, right? In the doorway.
Right.
And they go into house two. Then what happens in house two?
Well, so again, there's this imminent fear of insurgency right there,
right.
the bad guys, around every corner. So, they throw a grenade into, what turns out later to be a small room. It doesn't go off. They re-enter the house. They throw another one in. It does go off. They check that. They start clearing rooms individually. And Mendoza himself actually discovers that there are only, he sees down the hallway that a woman has opened the door and then closes the door. He's the one who discovers that there are innocent people in the back bedroom of that house. But so they clear the house. They determine that to be the case, and then they leave the house. Basically, there's no danger. Those people are not dead yet. Marines go back into that house and execute those. I'll call them now witnesses.
Okay.
Wooderich isn't in there. Wooderich may know that they're in there and going in to make a final check, a final sweep to see if there's any insurgents in there. But he certainly must have heard gunfire and I don't know whether he asked him about it afterward or not. But then they decide that the trail has gone cold. There isn't any threat anymore.
Can I stop you and ask you to, a little bit more granularity? Mendoza looks into the bedroom. He knows that there are women and children back there.
So that's his. I want to stop you too. That's his story. But what we believe really happened is, what we know happened is, an unexploded grenade is later found
right.
in that room.
Right.
So he himself decided to clear that room. So he opened the door, threw a grenade in, and it didn't go off.
Okay.
It didn't go off. But we believe that's when he realized that there were, he could see the short time the door was open that there were, women and children in there and probably saw no threat, but who knows what he saw.
Okay.
And then he was able to tell, another Marine, what he saw in there, and so they knew.
And the other Marine
they knew that there were people in there.
Okay.
They knew that there were people in there.
And the other Marine is Lance Corporal Tatum.
according to Lance Cripple Tatum. That's exactly right.
Yeah, according to Mendoza, anyway. Okay.
Right, according to Mendoza. Yeah, and then we know that Sherritt went back into that house before they left that site. Sherritt went back into that house, and we know he fired in that room, and we know Mendoza fired in that room because he's positively identified by a survivor. In later testimony, there was one survivor in that room, a young woman. And so that's when those deaths occur. And most of the deaths in House 1 occur because Sherritt and Tatum, both veterans of Fallujah, both veterans of the Battle of Fallujah, when 3-1 was there before, decide they're going to go back to that house and double check. And we use the term dead check. We believe they went back and dead checked people and actually killed people who weren't dead at the time. There's evidence that people were killed not on the first sweep through, but on the second visit to that house by Marines. And then later, I skipped over the fact where, you know, after the IED went off, they killed four people, or five people at roadside. And
right,
then later
right.
in the afternoon, they killed the four guys, in House 4.
Okay.
So that's basically the sequence of events, but all of that was going to be revealed in the trial.
And that's the
bad thing. Yeah, and had we gone through the rest of the trial and we had the forensics guys testify, we would have been able to argue to the jury about that sequence of events, and it would have been supported by the statements, Sherritt's statement, and the forensic evidence, and the house of cards would fall apart. And so before the house of cards built by the prosecution on the theory that Cesar Woodrich led his Marines on a rampage fell apart, they ended the trial. They brought me the offer. We accepted the offer. And the world never learned the truth about what happened to Hodita.
One of the things that in the documentary House 2 that is one of the key points of the documentary is when the NCIS agent puts together who he believed was in there, and you have a diagram of the way the bodies laid in the bedroom, and where Mendoza
right.
stood and where the second shooter stood, and that they believed the NCIS agents believed based on the forensics that the second shooter was Tatum. And you're left scratching your head, you know, wondering how could this case have gone so wrong for the prosecution, and the anger and anxiety certainly that you would expect from Iraq was visible on the news. As we wind this down and we move to lessons learned, how did it go so wrong for the prosecution? Is it part convening authority as he leans to be lenient on more junior Marines and then believing in their statements, crafting a narrative against Stetson Woodrich? How does it go so wrong?
I'll say it
because the conclusion of the forensics is that the shooters were all immunized. All four of the Marines, and then a fifth in Mendoza, all shot people that were innocent that day.
Right.
One of them was published. Not one of them was punished. And the reason that
right.
Stetson Woodrich wasn't punished was because they didn't have the evidence to prove any of the assertions or any of the charges that they made against him. None of the forensics.
Couldn't have said it better.
Okay,
could not have said it better.
That's my understanding. How does it get that screwed up?
Well, I have a theory about that, and my theory is that the reserve Marine officer who was brought in to be the lead prosecutor on this case, I believe he did a read through of the evidence that was made available to him when he first joined the case, and I believe he formed a theory of what happened that day, and it was the rampage theory. It was the staff sergeant or the Sergeant Woodrich led him on a rampage. And I think it so appealed to him and so fit, made such a good explanation for what happened that did not indict the Marine Corps. So it had that side benefit of not implicating the Marine Corps or Marine Corps training or Marine Corps doctrine in it. I think that's a theory that he believed that he had to pursue for the better of the Marine Corps and for the better of the case. And I think as evidence came to his attention that disputed that theory or that did violence to that theory, I think he minimized it in his own mind and actively disregarded it. But at the same time that was happening, it was also hurting his case. So I think that in order to shore up his case, he sought immunity and charges being dropped for the other Marines in an effort to try to strengthen their testimony. I mean, it's a flawed way to do that, but I believe that he became so personally and professionally invested in that original story, that original theory of his prosecution that he was going to want to sell to a jury, that he was either unwilling or unable or perhaps too far down the path to consider altering his course and changing his theory to fit the forensic evidence. So I think, and plus, if you've got a convening authority, I want to mention what you said, you've got a convening authority who doesn't want to prosecute Marines for doing their job. He doesn't want to criminalize mistakes, as he put it. So what you have working there in General Mattis's mind is you've got a confirmation bias. You've got a bias in favor of Marines. And so if somebody's coming and saying, well, these Marines were led astray by somebody else, you know, that's a story you can believe, and that's a story you may want to believe. You wouldn't want to believe that a whole group of Marines would do something bad, because your training is so good and your doctrine is so good and your ethics are so good, your honor. So I think it was those two things, but I think primarily it was an inexperienced prosecutor making a series of mistakes that simply compounded one another and ended up sort of destroying his own case from within, if you will, making it unwinnable by the time we got to trial. But the problem he was seeing as we were crushing all of his witnesses was the truth is going to come out, and the truth is not only going to hurt his reputation, he may have even considered that it might hurt the Marine Corps,
and that's why he
pulled the plug.
Okay, and that is Lieutenant Colonel Sullivan.
Yes.
Okay.
I want to caveat that. I caveat by saying, repeating, that's just my theory.
Right.
I don't know because I've never talked to him about that.
So he might
tell you a completely different version of events, but that's just the way it looked to me from my perspective.
Right. Lessons learned. We've described the events in and around Haditha for the last 2.5 hours to get to this point. You and I were talking yesterday about your desire to turn this into some kind of class given at the basic school, and I said, you know, at the Staff NCO Academy, at the NCO Academy, at SOI, to me this ought to be something that we look at hard. And again, there's nothing we can do to reverse the past. The only thing we can do is to commit to be a better version of what we are, and not only make that commitment, but put it into our training to look at this stuff, and to have young leaders consider, hey, this may darken my doorstep. Okay, so under the broad heading of keep your honor clean. Under the specific heading of is I have to live with what I do, under the heading of my Marines unwittingly, because they're younger, they're not as older as we are, they will have to live with what they do as well. This is worthy of dissection, discussion,
and reflection, so that if it does come your way, you can do the right thing. And you'll do the right thing just as you know how to do fire movement at night, execute an ambush, because you've gone down this road before in detail, and you've reflected on it. So let me ask you, lessons learned. And we'll go by phase. Pre-deployment training that they received, was there something missing? Is there a lesson learned about something missing in pre-deployment training? Because I've said this, clear never means to kill civilians. Right? Is somebody confused about that? We need to unconfuse them. So is there something that we missed in the pre-deployment training?
So I thought about that, and I would have to say I don't think there's anything we missed in the pre-deployment training, because I don't think that can be isolated as a contributing factor here. What I do know about Marine Corps combat training is that it evolves. It evolves throughout across conflicts and within conflicts. So back in my day, you know, some of my instructors were Vietnam veterans, you know, right. And they would tell us about lessons they learned that they didn't know before we had engagement in the Vietnam War. There were new kinds of warfare, the asymmetric warfare that were insurgencies and counterinsurgencies tactics that were learned in that war. Similarly, we've learned things from Iraq. We've learned things from Afghanistan. And we know for a fact that these are long-lasting conflicts, particularly Afghanistan, and we know that Marine Corps training has evolved based on lessons learned, mistakes made, lives lost. So I think that's occurring on a regular basis. I'm not sure that the lessons that can be learned from Haditha have been taught anywhere, because to the extent that they have been, they've probably been based on an inaccurate narrative, because what happened and how it was dealt with and how it was handled or not handled within a particular unit or within the justice system hasn't been explored, and I think it needs to be. And I break it down a different way, and we'll talk about phases, but I wouldn't call out the pre-deployment training as contributory contributing to the bad things that happened in Haditha in any way.
Let me just tell you what, in sitting here listening to it, okay, to me, what is the position of the squad leader when we begin to clear, right? And what do we do if we're beginning to encounter civilians, if we're beginning to encounter no weapons, and things aren't the supposition when somebody told me clear, based on, you know, we heard some shots fired, is there's bad guys in there. I'm beginning to see indications based on the bodies of women and children, there's no bad guys here. Where is the squad leader? What is the responsibility of, after we throw the grenade in, after we shoot everybody and we look, isn't somebody supposed to yell, Staff Sergeant or Sergeant W, get up here? Isn't somebody supposed to say that? And if that's omitted from the training, then I would say that's not a small omission, right?
Right.
That's not a small omission. Now, in my opinion, that doesn't forgive what happened, because you don't got to be a rocket scientist to know that, one, we're not the bad guys. We're the fucking good guys. All right? And when something goes wrong, that does happen. But our job is to correct it quickly and not make it worse.
Yeah.
Okay. So phase one. How about during the investigation, during the, what I call the internal period, which would have been from November 19th until the Time article is published? Your lessons learned on that when it wasn't investigated.
Well, I think that's the pivotal moment in the whole case. It's the decision, or the failure to make a decision to investigate what happened. And you don't even have to call it an investigation. You can call it an inquiry. You know, you can call it an after action, a collection of facts. You don't have to make it sound, you don't have to point it at the Marines. The very best way to handle it, and it's easy for us to say many years later, is, you know, every commander who encounters, in combat, whose Marines, actions result in civilian casualties has to investigate. And I'll bet you they're teaching that now, and I'll bet you they're requiring that now, and I'll bet you that's not optional, to the extent that it may have been then. But I mean that was just unforgivable to me that you don't investigate. And we talked about this before. You get one of two outcomes. You either get vindication for your Marines, which is a really good reason to have investigated, or you find out people did bad things either intentionally, unintentionally, and you either hold them accountable disciplinary wise, or you improve your training. You know, if it was unintentional, you go into the next engagement better, sharper, and looking out for things that maybe you didn't know to look out for before. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you go into a house, you're ordered to clear. Yeah, and that's another thing. So the young lieutenant whose first day is in combat, he says clear south.
Right.
Well, how far south? How many clicks? Just that house? Two houses after? When do you want me to come back, lieutenant? You know? What are my indications about when I'm done clearing? And that wasn't there. And then back to your point about when do you stop? You know, when do you stop? Do you stop when you first see a civilian casualty or cause a civilian casualty? Do you stop a moment and wait? Wait a minute. Do we hear anything? Let's clear these rooms one at a time. Let's not throw a grenade into the next room unless we have an indication. I don't know. I'm not the expert in tactics, of course.
Right.
But you're right. We talked about this. I've talked about this for years, and that is, had they stopped in house one, it would have, we might not have even had charges against anybody.
Right.
Because they clear a house, they believe an insurgent is in there, they believe an insurgent has been shooting from that house or near that house, and they go through, and maybe one or two people are killed, you know, in the heat of nervousness and in danger, but then you find nobody there, maybe you're done. You know, maybe you were wrong, or maybe the guy's gone. When the trail goes cold, the trail goes cold. You just don't go throwing grenades into every house up and down the street until you think you find the guy, like, just to your point.
The next phase, in terms of the external phase, a lesson learned, the Time article is published, the external investigations happen, NCIS shows up, and then ultimately charges are filed, would be the next phase of how you and I talked. Is there a lesson learned in retrospect from your perspective?
The investigation phase?
Yeah, in the external phase when the Time article
is published. External, okay.
The Time article is published, NCIS begins to investigate, and then charges are filed. Is there a lesson in there? Or is that all now playing, it's all playing the form, right? But, and the die is cast, you know, right? Statements are going to be made, right? So essentially this thing's moving forward, I don't know. Your thoughts on lessons learned?
I do have lessons learned. So the lesson learned there, from a mistake that was made, I believe this wholeheartedly, and that is that, if you've determined that the killings that occurred were not justified and were a result of a malfeasance, either intentionally or unintentionally, just, you know, being reckless or whatever it was, then I believe the Marine Corps had an obligation at that point to charge, unless the conditions were so crystal clear to not be a problem, that every Marine who fired a weapon that could have killed a human being that day, or that did kill a human being that day, each of those cases should be fully vetted, should be fully investigated and fully explored. And, if there's not an apparent, justified, engagement of a human being, if it's not on its face justified, then it, you know, it could have been an accident, or it could have been intentional, or it could have been criminal, in other words, then I think every Marine who fired a weapon that day that impacted the civilian should have been charged and held to account for their actions. Because if you don't do that, you don't have a dialogue, you don't have a crucible of a trial, or at least a preliminary hearing that they call Article 32 investigations now, a preliminary hearing, where the evidence is brought out and it's turned around and looked at from different angles and explored by defense counsel and prosecutors. Looking backwards now in time, had every single Marine who killed a civilian that day been put through the crucible of the military justice process, at least by way of a preliminary hearing, more of the facts would have come out. Defenses would have been raised. Maybe not everybody would have been convicted. Maybe even guilty people, some guilty Marines might not have been convicted. But if you just let everybody go, you're never going to have that process where the truth is sought, you know, where a jury or a judge looks at a prosecutor who's trying to prove guilt, a defense counselor who's trying to establish innocence. Those two forces collide in the crucible of a search for the truth. If you don't have that happen in every case, then you're never going to get a full picture of who did what to whom and to what extent, who's responsible, who's not responsible. If you just pick one guy and you pick wrong, then you never learn anything.
All right. Next phase is the adjudication of some cases, and then immunity being granted. Lesson learned from that?
Well, the lesson learned from that, I think, is if you got a group of prosecutors in a room and you walk them through a timeline as to how those cases were managed and how they were then sort of discarded or dismissed, I think professional prosecutors would have a problem with that. And I think they would say that that's not doctrine, that's not best practices. So I think the lesson learned from that is the best practices of a multi-defendant prosecution were not employed in this case. And that is that once you determine that there's evidence of criminal misconduct, then you take consistent action in every case. You handle every case the same way. You don't give any special handling just because they have a better statement that you can use against a different guy. You give everybody equal handling. You give everybody an opportunity to account for their actions, as I said before, and you start with the least culpable and you work up to who you think might be the most culpable. But unless you do that, you're never going to create any confidence that you're getting justice out of the results of those cases.
And they were at that point given the variance in statements, the contradictory nature of different statements that were given. And then on top of that, layer the forensic evidence that doesn't corroborate any of it.
Right.
So there was.
Right.
Okay. All right.
So what I'm not saying, what we don't want to say here is a lesson learned is when the evidence is too hard to figure out, you just don't do anything at all.
Right.
You still have to.
I think your point is well made. You handle them in a uniform style. Because I guess for us to, you're going to have to do one of two things. You're either going to have to handle them in a uniform style, in which case you might have to lower charges to get convictions.
Right.
But you will get convictions. Or you're going to have to make some kind of decision, which is the road they went down, in terms of who's telling the truth. So I think right. There's a fork in the road, and I'm not a lawyer. But I think there's a fork in the road. Whether we believe nobody's telling the truth, and in that case we're going to have to go this way, or we believe these guys are telling the truth, and we're going to load up on those guys, and God help us if we're wrong.
Right. Right.
Lessons out of the court martial itself, as you reflect on the court martial itself, or by that time, this is the second time I'll say that, is the die already cast?
Well, I think by the time we get to the court-martial, the die is cast, because if you're going to one of the things that I called to the attention of one of the prosecutors at an earlier phase was, you know, you've got these contradictory statements, and you can't how do you justify in your own mind putting all this contradictory evidence on? And the prosecutor's response to me was, well, my obligation is to bring all the evidence to the jury so they can sort out what happened. In other words, he didn't feel it was his obligation to choose which witnesses to believe and which not to believe, and therefore to sponsor only the witnesses that he believed were telling the truth. And that's just, I mean, if you said that to any practicing trial lawyer, I'd say, well, you know, that's just not the way you do things, because, I mean, in all honesty, it's not ethical. It's not ethical to sponsor two opposing theories of guilt that cannot, you know, both of which cannot be true.
Right.
So it's kind of a cop out, and that's another thing that I can't explain, because I said most lawyers understand that. It could have been that he was directed to do that. You know, it could have been that he didn't have any choice but to do that, and what he was communicating to me that he was being ordered to do it. You know, but that wasn't the way it was presented. So, I think I like the way you said it. By the time we got to trial, the die was cast, and things were only going to go badly for the prosecution's case. I don't think it was investigated poorly. I think the cases were managed by the lawyers poorly. I don't think that the forensics guys, they did their job the best they could. The guys who interviewed witnesses, they did the job the best they could. You know, they didn't, they just did what NCIS does, and they produced the results. I think the results or the data that they collected was mishandled, mismanaged, and misapplied in court.
It's almost like if you begin to assemble the case from the statements, you're already on the wrong path. But if you begin to assemble the case from the forensics, which has no advocate, then you I think get pointed in a different direction. Two more questions, Neil, and I'll let you go. One, should officers in these cases be afraid of investigations? Is an investigation your friend?
Well, so let me modify what you said. I shouldn't say never. You should only be afraid of an investigation if you know you have committed misconduct yourself. Anybody who's committed misconduct should be afraid of investigation, because accountability actions can be taken on the back end. You know, but generally speaking, all leaders should welcome investigations, because they're going to impartial investigations by, let's say, third parties or third party agencies, because those are going to give the closest to objective results. And there are two outcomes. One is whatever's being investigated is cleared, or whoever's being investigated is cleared, because that's a benefit of an investigation too. Or if a leader directs an investigation and it implicates someone in misconduct or malfeasance, or however you want to say that, then it's the leader's responsibility to hold that individual accountable for the benefit of everyone else. Because the worst kind of leader is one who looks the other way in the face of misconduct or disciplinary type misconduct, and doesn't take disciplinary action, because that has a terrible impact on morale. If good people see bad people getting away with things, they wonder where the fairness is. They wonder where the justice is. They wonder why they're following the rules and nobody else is.
You know, that one of the comments in the documentary that is pregnant with that emotion is the Het Marine who took those pictures, and then he put them on his laptop to save them, but nobody came for him. And in the documentary House 2, you can see the emotion. He talks about, you know, putting numbers on the feet of children, and how that still haunts him. The pictures haunt him. But how troubling
the fact that nobody was interested in the pictures was. And
right.
Yeah, and so you feel that sentiment. So you know, in terms of keeping your honor clean, look, sometimes bad things happen. If your intention wasn't bad, I think you would echo me. You should never be afraid of an investigation. At worst, they're going to find that you made a mistake. And in the confusing world of combat, mistakes do get made, right?
Yep.
And so if your intent wasn't to do harm and harm happened, there's no reason for you to be afraid of an investigation.
Right.
You're going to just, you know, take responsibility for what happened and make sure the truth comes out. Because if you don't, what happens is what you saw in how Haditha unfolded, which is the Marine Corps standing there with black eyes because the commanders in charge of it didn't do what they should have done, which was investigate. If they would investigate it, right. They would have got to ground, in my opinion, they would have got to ground truth early. The appropriate people would have been punished, and the institution acquits itself well. In the end, the institution doesn't acquit itself well. And final question, how's Staff Sergeant Woodrich was reduced to the rank of private given his general discharge under honorable conditions. How is he doing today?
He's doing great, Mac. He's a, of course, he's a civilian now. He's in the IT industry. One of the ways he spent his 6 years waiting for his day in court was he took a lot of off-duty education in information technology and got a lot of certifications, you know, on his own dime or with tuition assistance while he was on active duty, and created a new career for himself out of whole cloth, basically, and now is gainfully employed. I won't tell you where he's living, but he's recently, I think earlier this year, remarried, has, you know, still the father of his three beautiful daughters, and just doing great. He told me he's in the best health and fitness of his life. So he's PTN and he's enjoying life and making good money in the IT industry and kind of doesn't want to revisit all this.
Right.
Doesn't have an interest in interviews or in media coverage or anything like that. But from my perspective, a very mentally healthy and resilient American who admirably, in my eyes, as a Marine. From the very beginning, and in his earliest statement in that initial inquiry that was done in the Bargewell investigation, took responsibility for what his Marines did. I mean, he signed that. You know, whatever happened is my responsibility, and that was the first thing he said.
After 2 hours,
he maintained that throughout.
After 2 hours and 57 minutes, is there anything that I've not asked you about lessons learned? Or about this case that you want to make sure that young Marine leaders or old Marine leaders know before we end?
I think no, not generally leaders, but I think that this the facts of this incident, this whole Haditha matter, I think need to be incorporated into training, not just for leaders, but kind of at the tactical level too. So I'm thinking the tactical level, the small unit leader level, and the senior leader level as well. So I think, you know, we talked a lot about lessons learned today, and I think there are lessons for every level of Marine Corps honor, if you will, and Marine Corps integrity. You know, we found out some good things that can happen, you know, the Marines coming forward and, you know, collecting information and the Lance Corporal who took the pictures and caring so much about what had happened. We have people who would, you know, throw their fellow Marines under the bus. I think that what happened tactically that day and what happened, the question of how do you deal with your junior, mid-level, and senior leadership responsibilities when things go horribly wrong. How do you do that? how would you do that? How would you have handled this differently? And I think there are lessons for all levels of Marine Corps operations and leadership that grew out of the Haditha case, and I would love to see some of these incorporated into Marine Corps training.
Neil Puckett, for the last 3 hours. Neil, first of all, I cannot say thank you enough, because when I conceived of All Marine Radio, it was discussions like this, meaningful, long format, in depth, that Marine leaders could listen to, that would give them wisdom. Should war ever darken our doorstep again, and it will, and should they have to sail into it, and they will. But it's conversations like this. One, telling yourself this could happen to me. Two, understanding investigations are your friend, and they're the friend of the institution. And they're ultimately a Marine's friend as well. And those are all truths. They're universal truths. And as a leader, you have to embrace them. And then I think embracing that, only stiffens your spine. And gives you kind of a guide map that if it does come your way, if it does darken your doorstep, that I know what I need to do. So thank you very, very, very much for doing this. I truly appreciate it.
My pleasure, Mac, and best of luck to you and the program. And I just hope that somebody who's listening can help us get more visibility on this type of issue and for the betterment of the Marine Corps.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Neil Puckett, more of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. That'll do it. Interesting stuff. Again, want to thank Neil Puckett for donating in the last couple weeks, probably close to 5-6 hours of his time to make us all smarter. So what I hope to do in the future is, you know, a lot of people that are involved, that were involved in this, won't talk about it. For a variety of reasons. But I'm sure there are some that would love to share theirs in the right forum, and hopefully All Marine Radio is the right forum for it. So looking for others that have been involved in different parts of it, from the NCIS guys that I saw interviewed for the documentary, to possibly people that, you know, work for the prosecution. And again, the thought is not, again, to relitigate it, to assign blame. But it's to explore different pieces of it, so that the next time somebody goes forward, if they've listened to this, it will look familiar to them. Okay? It will look familiar to them. I've studied this, right? I know what's supposed to happen. And I'm not going to be afraid of it, because I know I didn't do anything wrong. Something bad might have happened, but I didn't do anything wrong. And again, I think it is just part of how do you keep your honor clean inside of an event that can oftentimes search for honor. And that is the killing and capturing of other human beings in a war in which in our case, Marines, are being killed and wounded and disfigured. So it's not easy stuff. And so we approach it in that vein. So I hope you enjoyed the interview. I thoroughly enjoyed the whole process of discovery relative to it. And I'm smarter for it now. Now I'm more interested in it. I'm more interested in reading different things about the case. Some of the nuanced things. So, again, my thanks to retired United States Marine Corps Major Neil Puckett. So, my thanks to him for coming on and doing that. Don't touch that dial. All Marine Radio continues if you're just tuning in. Have a great day on a Wednesday All Marine Radio, over and out.